to tell you that I am still number one P pro tem of the Black Eyed Peas Society of America. I have been on a point in 60 minutes. I have solaced myself by thinking that conversion does have its good works after all. For 5 years, I have been belaboring that very lovely, enchanting, brilliant, erudite, and misguided lady with the sound doctrine of conservatism, the profit motive, the incentives of the marketplace. We debated, as a matter of fact, the so-called obscene profits of the oil companies, and I wound up by saying that I had never met an honest prophet I really disliked. Having worked on Shana for 5 years, I really ought not to be disturbed that at last she quit because they wouldn't pay her more money. A moment that makes a man quietly proud, if I may say so. I think perhaps you already have been sufficiently welcome to New Orleans, but if not, I would add my welcome, if I may. I have fairly solid credentials to welcome you to New Orleans. This was my father's home and my grandfather's home and my great-grandfather's home. It was a very prolific family. My father was one of 13 children, of whom 11 survived. The 11 had multitudinous offspring of their own. I have not let any of them know I am in New Orleans today, because God bless all of my maiden aunts, cousins, nieces, nephews, and the like. When they find I am in town and making a speech, they come and occupy the first four rows and clap incessantly. Several of them are deaf, which accounts for the applause. But New Orleans has been my second home after Virginia for a good many years. And some of you, I believe, may not have been here before or may not have been here often, and you will find it an enchanting city, fuller of villains and people who will treat you shabbily than any other city. So do have a great time in the old quarter and keep New Orleans green. It is a lovely city indeed. I like the theme of your program, of course, because I am, as you will gather, a Southerner. I myself was born in Oklahoma City, where my father had moved just after World War I. But my antecedents are in the South, and when it came time for me to go to work, having graduated from the University of Missouri, I came to Richmond, Virginia, which is the quintessence of the South, as everyone knows. Like Charleston, it is a holy city. Richmond dwells by the noble James. The cub reporter who comes to Richmond is swiftly indoctrinated in various principles that he is expected to uphold thereafter. I still recall an interview that I had as a young feature writer along about 1941 or 42 with one of the old grand dames who lived in the Hotel Jefferson down on the Franklin Street side on the mezzanine level. A perfectly typical white-haired old lady with the black choker, if you can imagine, and a certain crinoline air about her. And I've forgotten the occasion of the interview, but in any event, she undertook to instruct me as an alien outlander from Missouri by way of Oklahoma in what being a Virginian was all about. "The first thing you should know, young man," she said to me, "is that we have lived longer under the flag of England than we have lived under the flag of the United States." And I went back to the city room and did a little subtraction, and by George, she was right. This was perfectly true in Virginia in 1942. If you go back to 1607, quite true indeed. They had, in fact, lived longer under the flag of England, and she meant to keep it that way if she could. The other flag, of course, under which they lived was the flag of the Confederate States of America. Not so much as heard about the dear old CSA anymore. But I was recently enchanted by an article in the American Spectator that many of you may have seen, having to do with the exchange rate between United States dollars and Confederate dollars. There's a moral here in this. As recently as 1960, it was 1-to-1. One United States dollar bought one Confederate dollar. But now if you go to the souvenir stands of Atlanta or Charleston or here in New Orleans, you will find that one Confederate dollar sells for 8 United States dollars. Tells you something about the United States dollar, but it tells you something also about the Confederate dollar. Because the reason for the strength and the purity of the Confederate dollar, obviously, is that we of the Confederate States of America have not had an unbalanced budget for more than 100 years. South is a great place, and you're going to be hearing a lot about it in the next couple of days, this afternoon, tomorrow. And I don't mean to intrude upon some of the things that the other speakers will say, but the South is a great place for all of you to gather for a re-examination of conservative principles. Certainly, Southern politics are quintessentially conservative. Ours is the inheritance of John Randolph, I think, among other statesmen. The tragedy of secession, the whole war for Southern independence, as Dr. Freeman used to identify it, was an essentially conservative movement. It resulted in part from the compact theory of the Constitution, a theory that every true Southerner subscribes to, embedded in the text of the document itself, that our government is in fact a compact among the states. The compact could not have become operative without the ratification of a certain number of states. Whenever we act politically to this day in this country, we act through the mechanisms of our states. The theory of states' rights is deeply ingrained in Southern conservatism. Ours is the land of states' rights. And by a peculiar circumstance, even the peculiar institution, as it was dubbed, was in essence a conservative institution in that, ironically, tragically, mistakenly, the black people were then regarded as property. And it was in defense of a right of property, however misguided that defense may have been, that at least a part of the war for Southern independence was founded. You're going to hear a little something about Southern religion, endemic in this region. As John Howard may have indicated to you, I'm at the moment in a fairly frenetic drive that began in Houston about midday yesterday and will wind up at Birmingham about noon tomorrow. I'm trying to drive across a little chunk of the South to reabsorb a part of the impressions of my region. The radio in the Mammoth Avis Chrysler that I'm navigating around in is tuned to nothing but rock music and sermons. The preachers of the South go on from night to day, from morning all afternoon. There is never a time in the South when spinning that radio dial, tuning, you cannot get somebody, some fundamentalist, somewhere, beseeching you to come back to Jesus and send him $5. This is a part of the religion of the South. You're going to hear something about Southern literature, which is, I think, distinctively Southern in a way that only perhaps the Western literature, and that a particular genre, is distinctive in itself. The Gothic nature of Southern literature and the agrarian nature of Southern poetry, these are endemic to our region, and they too are essentially conservative. And perhaps something of Southern manners. There's a great thing about Southern manners. It is the old oil that lubricates the gears of society. And here in the South, we are full of the old oil. Among other things we are full of, bourbon, whiskey, and other good things. But the oil of manners is here. I remember writing to my mother in Oklahoma City shortly after I became a reporter in Richmond that the thing that impressed me most about being in Richmond in Virginia was the incessant use of the word sir. You watch for it in Virginia or traveling around the South. Sir is used constantly to equals, to inferiors, to superiors. Yes, sir. What was that, sir? Yes, sir. No, sir. Always. It is a part of the courtesy and the hospitality and the essential civility of the South. And I, as a Southerner, am very well pleased with it. We do have our drawbacks in the South. There are trashy people here, and people without civility, people with no manners. And if you have been in Atlanta lately, you will know that Atlanta claims a distinction it would as soon do without. It is now the murder capital of the world. So we profess no claims to perfection in the South, but I believe that all of you who profess the conservative faith will find yourselves very much at home in the disquisitions of the next afternoon and day. Don Lipsett, your Commodore, asked me to talk as a Southern newspaper man. with my own reflections upon the name and nature of conservatism in American life. I do so with a great deal of reluctance in this particular gathering. I don't mean to make apologies. It's a bad way to begin any sort of conversation. I've never professed to be an intellectual, so forgive me if my random reflections are those of a newspaper man who has thought about these things, however, off and on, and fairly steadily for nearly 40 years. So in my own poor amateur way, let me undertake to discuss with you in my time what seems to me, as a Southern newspaper man, the nature of conservatism and the distinctions between our philosophy and that which is identified these days as liberalism. I'm going to submit to you that there is a mild conservative resurgence in the country. Nothing so definite, so strong, as to be described as a conservative movement, perhaps not even as a conservative trend, but I think there is a very definite sort of conservative drift that is reflected in various ways. It occurs to me increasingly these days that the labels of conservative and liberal are now, in American politics, the only labels that count, that have any meaning. For the past 20 years, the old labels of Democrat and Republican have steadily diminished in their meaning until now. I would submit to you that they have virtually no meaning at all. We have lost virtually all of the substance of our two-party system and are clinging forlornly but necessarily simply to the form of a two-party system. These old labels of Democrat and Republican are not going to be lightly abandoned. Federal and state legislatures are organized in this way. The committees of Congress are organized in this way. Various federal commissions are organized in this way in terms of so many majority and so many minority members. We keep score in this fashion. We elect our congressional leadership according to party labels. But when this particular Congress, the 96th, began, we had in the Senate 58 persons who called themselves Democrats, 41 who turned themselves Republicans, and one independent, Harry Byrd of Virginia. By the same token, when this Congress began, we had 276 persons in the House who styled themselves Democrats, and 157 who styled themselves Republican. But the labels, obviously, after the opening day, when Senator Robert Byrd was elected in the Senate and Tip O'Neill was elected in the House, when those elections were taken, the labels vanished. They ceased to have any meaning at all. There is now in the Congress no semblance of party regularity, nothing approaching party loyalty. There is no party discipline. And we have a grave question before us in American politics. Where do we go if we are to let the two-party system as a system reduce itself to a sham? I have no particular answers for you, but I do submit that this is not thought about enough. In any event, to return to my main point, the dichotomy between liberal and conservative is the dichotomy that means something in our politics, and it is measurable to a degree. Such institutions as Congressional Quarterly regularly tot up a score in terms of a conservative coalition. We have polls, such as the ones conducted by CBS News and the New York Times, that attempt to define conservative and liberal attitudes. I'm not sure they ask the right questions, but they make a pitch in that area. And these polls, for whatever they may be worth, show that our people are getting measurably more conservative all the time. As I say, the questions puzzle me. I remember a story that George Will tells about the time he was asked to go out to American University in Watergate days to present a conservative point of view in an altogether liberal institution. And George, who was pretty well, you know, saturated with the Watergate story, found himself asking himself as he crossed the threshold into the hall, what, after all, is the conservative view of burglary? He had some problems there. So these various polls, I think, may sometimes ask the wrong questions about what conservative attitudes are, but nevertheless, we do have them, and they show we are getting more conservative. We still have such viable institutions as the American Conservative Union, and there are organizations, ADA, for example, that do not hesitate to describe themselves as liberal organizations. So the meaning of these two terms, liberal and conservative, I believe is far more clear to the American electorate than the meaning of these amorphous terms, Republican and Democrat. So it seems to me that this is where our fundamental separation politically lies. We ought to explore, I think, a little more deeply, those of us who are conservatives, into what is meant by our philosophy. I can offer you in my time here only my own impressions as a newspaper man, as an editor, columnist, what conservatism means to me. Conservatism to me embraces a body of attitudes, some attitudes that are reasoned and some that are intuitive, that are significantly different from those attitudes we identify as liberal. These differences obviously are not always consistent, for points of view blend and they run together and they run apart. Conservatism, as I've looked at it in America over these past 40 years, is not one monolithic establishment requiring an absolute identity of views. We do differ among ourselves. Last year, Mr. Buckley and I were pretty far apart on the Panama Canal. I expect John Howard and I are probably far apart on the decriminalization of marijuana. We have had our differences about the marching Nazis in Illinois, about arms limitation. There are conservatives on both sides of the arms limitation agreement that's now pending in the Senate. But as a general rule, it seems to me, conservatives do have a body of principles that carry on over into political action. I have put down for my own guidance 5 of these principles. The first of them, it seems to me, is belief in a divine order, in a grand design, in the mysteries of the universe, in the wonder, miracles of it all. I believe that this is fundamental to any sort of conservative philosophy, and it goes, of course, obviously beyond any sort of denominational thing. I'm indifferent to religious denominations. But I do believe, from what I've observed, that at the very bottom of any sort of principled conservatism is an acknowledgement that there is a divine power, a supreme intelligence out there somewhere that caused the planets to swing in their prescribed paths, that caused the seasons, that caused the rotation of the earth, that put seed in woman and seed in the ground. These things did not happen by accident, but by design. And we see this principle in our philosophy embodied in so recent a debate as that over the Tellico Dam and the Snail Darter. Many of you will have read Jim Buckley's excellent piece that carried recently in National Review. Speaking as a conservative, as a naturalist, with a keen appreciation and a profound understanding of the mysteries of the universe, Buckley came out on the side of the Snail Darter. Let the $100 million dam be torn down if need be, but let us preserve the genes of a species. It's a profoundly conservative doctrine that Jim Buckley was advancing there, because it is a doctrine born of the belief, the conviction, that we are children of God and not mere wards of the state. And this is fundamental. Secondly, is in my catalog of principles by which conservatives are identified, is that generally we hold to the conviction that there are, in fact, certain eternal verities. In Gerhardt's invocation a while ago, he began by his prayer to Almighty and Everlasting God. Almighty and Everlasting. And it is inherent in the conservative philosophy, it seems to me, to believe that there are principles, there are verities that are indeed almighty and everlasting, values and truths that endure through all ages and all governments. And it is our task intellectually and politically to identify these verities and to adapt them to our own time. One such verity, it seems to me, is the one that John Randolph laid down in his famous discourse on the matter of equality. You remember it when he arose in, I've forgotten whether it was the House or the Senate, suddenly to challenge the statement in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal. And he cried out, if you remember, Mr. Speaker, I do not believe it, sir. I do not believe it. For the best of all reasons, sir, because it is not true. And of course it is not true. And that is one of the eternal verities, that men are not created equal. We tend, by the same token, to doubt the popular myth that ours is a government of law and not of men. For one of the eternal verities is that ours government is, of course, a government of men. It's also a government of laws. But it is primarily a government of human beings. History is primarily biography. And that is a part of our eternal verities. We also believe in the eternal verity that the rule of law is indispensable to a free society, that there can be no free society without the rule of law. Without discipline and order, anarchy must prevail. We see this in the example of our public schools, which is the reason that conservatives, more than I think any other group in our society, are aroused, resentful, indignant, outraged by what is going on so widely in public education. We see it as the abandonment of discipline, as the abandonment of a rule of law in our schools, and we see anarchy prevailing. For a fourth one, we certainly, for the most part, not entirely, we are a little hypocritical in this next area, a little demagogic sometimes in this next area, which has to do with power. All of us in our intellectual cradles grew up with Lord Acton's dictum that all power tends to corrupt and absolute power tends to corrupt absolutely. This is, in fact, a part of conservative doctrine, and it is often honored more in the breach than in the allegiance. We believe, I think, we on the conservative side, that the excesses of power must be restrained at every point. We believe that this is inherent in the Constitution itself, that this is part of the essence of constitutional government, is to impose restraints upon power. I wish we were more consistent in warning against and working against the excesses of power in industry. We're not. In big business, we're not. In the press, we're not. In big labor, oh, we certainly are. In big labor. Big government, we certainly warn against the excesses of power there. But if we were consistent in our philosophy, we would at every point, I think, watch for the excessive concentrations of power and do something about them. I got in a good deal of trouble with some of my conservative brothers about a year ago, when, to my own astonishment, I crawled in bed with Senator Kennedy and Senator Bayh on a bill having to do with the horizontal divestiture of certain properties of the great petroleum companies. The purpose of the Kennedy-Bayh bill was to prevent the great petroleum companies from also investing in coal and uranium. And I thought this was a perfectly sound conservative idea. And as I say, some of my brothers were outraged. Exxon flew a Learjet full of its executives from Houston up to Washington to take me up to the mountaintop at the Hungarian restaurant there and to feed me full of Hungarian food and tell me how wrong I was. And they flew back to Houston the next day, I think, rather disappointed, because my conservative point of view was it is a bad, bad business to permit these vast petroleum companies, some of whom have budgets exceeding those of all but five countries in the whole world, to permit them to move not merely in petroleum but also into coal, into uranium, and into solar power, until they become not petroleum companies but energy companies, controlling by their investments the diversification and the investment here and there in energy, which is vital to us all. And I will continue to resist this kind of concentration of power. And I wish that many of my brothers on the conservative side were as consistent as I think I am consistent in opposing this kind of vast industrialization. We ought to believe in splitting up the great powers. I have no objection whatever to seeing General Motors carved up into pieces, if you please, or Exxon, if you please, carved up into pieces, because the power of these giant corporations now presses down upon our society. And free men and free women ought to think about these things. I was delighted to learn that Mel Bradford is about to edit an edition of the ratification debates, particularly that of my beloved Virginia in June of 1788. I go back to Eliot's debates In the same way that I often go back to Burke and to Gibbon, just to return to the fountainhead from which cometh all wisdom. If you have not read Eliot's debates, especially the Virginia debates, I would urge you to get yourself to the nearest library as fast as you get back to your various homes, institutions, and companies, and find Eliot's debates. They were transcribed, these debates that ran over a period of 3 weeks in Richmond, transcribed by a shorthand reporter, Robertson. The transcript reads as dramatically as any play you are likely to find on Broadway today. There were gathered in that schoolhouse down in the east end of Richmond some of the greatest minds of that generation. Pendleton was there, Madison, of course, Monroe. On the side of those opposing the Constitution, Patrick Henry, George Mason, William Grayson, great minds. And the theme that ran all the way through those debates in Virginia was that the Constitution was insufficient in this regard, that it did not impose sufficient restraints upon power. In a memorable passage, William Grayson stood up to say that power ought to have such checks and limitations as to prevent bad men from abusing it. Power ought to be granted on a supposition that men will be bad, for it may be eventually so. And Patrick Henry said this: too much suspicion may be corrected. If you give too little power today, you may give more tomorrow. But the reverse of that proposition will not hold. If you give too much power today, you cannot retake it tomorrow, for tomorrow will never come for that purpose. The steel thread that bound the Constitution together was the restraint upon power. At every point that there was a delegation of power, there was a snatching back of power. At every point there was a limitation, there were chains, there were restraints put around, or so they thought. In the veto, and the power to override a veto, and the requirement that appropriations must be for limited times, that the debates of the Congress must be published, all these were restraints upon power. And then finally, in the Bill of Rights, the total restraint upon power. The next point that I had among conservative principles is that we believe, by and large, that wisdom may not always lie in ancient institutions, but some measure of respect ought to be accorded long-established ways. It's not necessary, as so many of my brother Virginians do, to worship our ancestors. I think it would be folly to guarantee that age alone guarantees goodness. That is as untrue of political institutions as it is of eggs. But prudence does commend that we opt for that which has been tried and proved against that which has been untried and as yet unproved. Next point. In our philosophy, it seems to me, conservatism tends to emphasize the individual, the one man or the one woman, as distinguished from the group. Thus, conservatism puts great emphasis upon individual rights. On the other side, and I don't mean to lump all liberals in this, we find words of art: the case load, the housing project, the housing unit. Where on the conservative side, we tend to speak in terms of the man and the woman, the individual, in the home. We are not much wedded to case loads in our philosophy. We do believe in the right of the individual, by and large, to live his own little potty life as he pleases, so long as he does not interfere with the rights of anyone else. Next point. In my own philosophy, is that conservatism embraces a conviction that property rights lie at the very basis of human rights and must be preserved. It doesn't happen so often now, but it used to happen when I was out on the lecture trail 10, 12 years ago, that I would come out with a great ringing defense of property rights, and one of the bearded ones would arise in the audience and cry out, "Why don't you give as much emphasis to human rights as you do to property rights?" And with great applause. And I try to answer that, so far as I can perceive, property rights are the first of all human rights. They go back deeper and longer. I'm sure to the time when it was the caveman's "my cave, my tiger skin, my bone, my club." Property rights, they go as far back as we can go. They underlie all human rights. When we abandon respect, deference to property rights and their preservation, we have abandoned the fundamental, it seems to me, of our human rights. Next point in my own philosophy is that conservatives believe that diversity in most cases is much better than uniformity, that variety is better than regimentation. And for these reasons, we adhere stubbornly to the principle of federalism in our government, that the power of political experiment ought to be spread out among the states respectively. If we, on the conservative side, have one favorite passage of the Constitution, I suppose it would be the 10th Amendment, by which we assert that all power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. This is to us a keynote, because we believe it is in this fashion that error may be confined. And so if the state of Louisiana does something peculiarly stupid, at least the stupidity of Louisiana will be confined to this beloved state, and so on and so on. And therefore, we oppose such bills at the federal level as those proposing, say, no-fault automobile insurance, because our observation tells us that here, the states have been experimenting with no-fault insurance. And here it has seemed to work, and there it has seemed to fail. And here this ramification has succeeded, and somewhere else it has not worked as well as it had been supposed. And I'm delighted to see that, as part of this conservative drift that I perceive in Congress, no-fault insurance is going nowhere. That bill is dead. It will be left to the states, for good or ill, to experiment in this area and in other areas. And my next point is that conservatives, and especially I think Southern conservatives, tend to have a very strong sense of place. They do tend to root themselves in land or community or the state in which they dwell. Those of us on the conservative side, and especially Southern conservatives, cling to old buildings, old landmarks, as anchors against the winds of innovation. Now and then we fail. A band of lunatics in my beloved Richmond, Virginia, is trying to tear down our old city hall. Thankfully, an army of conservatives has risen against this insane project, and we hope to hold on to the city hall in Richmond. But these are peculiar aspects, I think, of the South. We are an old part of the nation, and we tend to like it that way, and hold on to the sense of place. Finally, in my list of conservative characteristics, is the importance that is attached to ritual, to ceremony, tradition, manners. We saw an uprising, especially among Southern Episcopalians, at the recent efforts at vandalism of the Book of Common Prayer. Southerners felt very strongly about this. Southern Catholics led the effort to hang on to the Latin in the Mass. Ritual is important to the Southerner. And I would submit to you, on a theme of contemporary politics, that this is one reason many Southerners have been quite disappointed in Jimmy Carter, is his abandonment of the ritual, the aura, the importance that had been attached to the presidential office. You remember that Mr. Carter came in with the determination to de-imperialize, in a marvelous verb, the office of the presidency. And he set about it systematically. Out went the limousines, in came the Volkswagens, out went the television sets, in came the old Crosby radios, out went the Marine band, in came a Marine combo. They no longer played Hail to the Chief, they played Hi to the Chief. Out went the red carpets. The cardigan sweater came on, the dog Grits lay at our feet, the president built a treehouse with his daughter Amy. In every way that Mr. Carter could, he sought to make the presidential office lower and common and less dignified. He went abroad in the land, saying in that peculiar voice of his to various audiences and to overnight guests in Yazoo City and Massachusetts, "I'm no better than you are." To which the automatic and instinctive reaction was, "If you're no better than we are, what are you doing in that office?" Ritual and ceremony are important, the aura of the presidency. I digress long enough to say that seriously, I think this has been one of Mr. Carter's greatest handicaps and underlies many of his failures as president, that he has not brought to the office the sense of dignity or presence that his predecessors had. The first president I ever saw was Roosevelt, and I saw him very briefly at one press conference as a Cub reporter. But when he was rolling in that wheelchair, you knew the president of the United States was there. Harry Truman was feisty. He was like Mencken's man who could strut sitting down. But he had that sense of presence. So too with Eisenhower, general of all the armies, and you knew it. He had that sense of command when he came in. Jack Kennedy, he had the charm and the arrogance that go with wealth. Big and tall, and you knew he was there. And Lyndon, Lyndon was maybe the first president I'm sure he was the first president I ever was embraced by. Lyndon had two embraces. One was known as the half Johnson on this arm. One was known as the full Johnson when he got you from behind. But he had a great sense of presence. My favorite Lyndon story is about the time he was at El Toro Air Base. And he had finished the program, whatever it was, and was marching across the tarmac. And he evidently hit it in the wrong direction. And a young lieutenant took him deferentially by the arm and said, "Mr. President, your helicopter is over there." And Lyndon looked down from that great height and patted him on the shoulder. And he said, "Son, they're all my helicopters." Sense of the power of the office. And Nixon had it, and Jerry Ford had it, but Mr. Carter, I think, has suffered because he has not had it. We do believe in ritual and ceremony and tradition, manners. Well, I would raise the question rhetorically, how fares the conservative philosophy in these regards today? And I think not too badly on the whole. We win a few, we lose a few, but as the saying goes, we always suit up. It's possible to make out a persuasive case, if not a convincing case, that over the past 20 years, conservatism, as Russell Kirk says, has been in a rout. Federal power has indeed grown tremendously. State powers have diminished. The power of eminent domain has been abused up to a point. Property rights are perhaps not as secure as they were. The role of religion in our society, I think, has declined. Equalizers have taken hold of our government in various ways. All this case can be made, but I think there is some evidence, the pollsters do turn it up, of a swing back toward conservatism, and of course this pleases me, except for the creation of a Department of Education, which I think was a fundamental error in our government. The 96th Congress has not done anything thus far that trespasses greatly upon conservative principles. Next year we may get a kind of health insurance program covering catastrophic illness. But other than that, I would not look for any great expansion of the powers of the federal government. On the whole, it seems to me we are getting back. Some devices are being used that I'm very dubious about. The legislative veto, for example, blurring the principle of separation of powers that may be levied against the Federal Trade Commission. But the record of legislation in the past 3 years, from our own point of view, is on the whole quite good. Down the drain have gone the cargo preference bill, the common site picketing bill, repeal of the Hatch Act, repeal of 14B, the bums rush registration bill. All of these things have been defeated. And very little new objectionable legislation has been put permanently on the books. There is a conservative mood in the Congress, manifested in various ways in tax legislation, and the suspicion that's being brought to the president's energy package, in the resistance to Birch Bayh's presidential election amendment to the Constitution. It's an outgrowth or a manifestation, perhaps, of the Proposition 13 spirit, but it's there. It's there. And I think if we breathe upon it in every way in the 1980 elections, that maybe we will go into the 97th Congress pretty well fixed for the 2 years that come after. So what I would submit to you is that conservatism is by no means the dead philosophy that it is sometimes regarded as. It does survive, it survives, flourishes, and I believe if we respect our own principles, understand them, apply them to contemporary legislative and political affairs, that the Republic indeed will survive. Thank you so very much.